KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Seattle.
I am not a dictator. I'm the president. So ultimately, if Mitch McConnell or John Boehner say we need to go to catch a plane, I can't have Secret Service block the doorway.
Tuitions, tolls, general tax increases, fees, anything that was required to have a two-thirds vote now simply does not.
When you have a two-thirds vote, you can't even close loopholes. I mean, you can barely decide that you want to go to lunch.
Ross Hunter of the State House of Representatives talking about yesterday's state Supreme Court ruling that the two-thirds supermajority is unconstitutional when it comes to legislating tax increases. Before that, you heard with somebody quite irate about that decision, State Senator Pam Roach. And before that, President Obama weighing in on the sequester. And we have in our studio two-thirds of our regular Friday panel.
The two-thirds vote.
Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger, is here with Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times, and marooned by malfunctioning traffic, malfunctioning bridges, I think, is the moss bag. Knute Berger, are you sitting in a parking lot?
I am.
Okay,
sitting
well,
in the old Mohai parking lot, but I have my cell phone.
You have your cell phone, so we can talk about...
as long as it holds out.
Okay, well, hopefully you've got a little charger.
Can we have a two-thirds vote to whether Skip talks?
Yeah, no.
You know, we not only have two-thirds, but we have a simple majority, so we're covered in both directions.
Northbound and southbound traffic is alternating on State Route 513. That's Montlake Boulevard at the Montlake Bridge, because there's a disabled vehicle, not the disabled bridge. So I guess that's good news. Well, let's start with the sequester, because the president did... get right on television this morning, and you know, he's been campaigning assiduously since the State of the Union address. So let's hear a couple things that the president said in his talk. He emphasized his concern about the impact the sequester would have on our economy.
At a time when our businesses have finally begun to get some traction, hiring new workers, bringing jobs back to America, we shouldn't be making a series of dumb, arbitrary cuts to things that businesses depend on and workers depend on, like education and research and infrastructure and defense. It's unnecessary, and at a time when too many Americans are still looking for work, it's inexcusable.
The president also expressed some frustration about how talks with Republican leadership was going.
I know that this has been some of the conventional wisdom that's been floating around Washington, that somehow, even though most people agree that I'm being reasonable, that most people agree I'm presenting a fair deal, the fact that they don't take it means that I should somehow, do a Jedi mind meld with these folks and convince them to do what's right.
That's President Obama speaking this morning about the impending sequester, 11:59 p.m. this evening. If Congress doesn't come to an agreement, massive spending cuts are going to kick in. And I was talking to Denny Heck, who represents the new 10th district, and I asked him what the chances were of agreement. And this is a quote: "I slim and none, and slim just walked out of the door."
Well, and they all headed for the airport. I saw a sort of a funny report of one of the network reporters interviewing all the folks as they were coming down the steps to leave town, and this was Dana Bash and she from CNN, and she kept saying, "Wait, where are you going?" And each one would say, some of them would blow right past her, but some would say, "I'm going to the airport."
You know, this president's week, their vacation or whatever it is.
No, I mean, it
today they're leaving today.
No, they were leaving yesterday,
oh, yesterday
after they realized that they couldn't get anywhere on the sequester. And she was stopping one after the next to say, "Where are you going?" "Well, I'm going home." "Well, wait a minute. Don't you know the sequester is going to happen and you're going to be out of town. What's that going to be like?" And each one would say, "Well, I spend my weekends with my family." Or they'd say, "You know, I can come back really quickly." But there was this sort of, in your earlier quote with the president,
can't block their way,
talking about he can't block. Well, they're closed the airport. No, I'm teasing. But it's just that It really has this feeling of dysfunction there. These guys are leaving. He's sitting there saying, I can't force them. And all the public wants to know is, why is there so much brinkmanship? It's always one of these things that will close down something near and dear to the public.
I actually wondered why they didn't get their pay docked.
That's a good question. I mean, it has the feel of a prefigured conclusion. They're leaving yesterday. They're leaving today. Everyone says, including Denny Heck, that the sequester is going to happen. And it's frustrating, and you can hear that frustration in Obama's voice. It's nice at least that the more frustrated he gets, the more vivid his imagery gets. And so he's talking about Jedi mind melds and
I love that.
The airport.
Knut, you're laughing
the
there.
Vulcans that did the mind meld.
Yeah, it was Vulcans that did the mind meld. And I don't think a mind meld is, well, maybe a mind takeover, because they just do not, on either side, seem like they're going to come to the middle there.
Well, I don't think there is a middle in the sense that the right wing of the Republican Party is essentially an anti-government wing, and as long as they're anti-government, the more damage they can do to the government, the better. And so for them, the sequester is a win. And throwing up roadblocks and creating dysfunction is a win, because it satisfies, even though they're the cause of it, it satisfies their narrative that government is dysfunctional. And, I think there's a deep philosophical difference. I don't think, people keep talking about finding a center. I don't think you find a center when, you've got one group that believes in government is a good thing and a helpful thing, and another group that believes it's evil.
Joni, I wanted to ask about one of your columnists in the Seattle Times, Danny Wesneat, wrote an interesting sort of conversation, a discussion about sequester, but also that notion that the sky is falling, America as we know it is destroyed as of, 12 tomorrow morning.
Well, he's playing off of the idea that, that these cuts in some of them will really hurt people, but there are small percentages. And so, a lot of private industry has gone through cuts that are way more than 5%. Although if you, figure in the months, it ends up being a little bit higher. The sequester, remember, different point I wanted to make, was supposed to be the thing that could never happen, mm-hmm. that it was the thing that everybody would avoid. The defense cuts were just too darn dramatic for anybody to allow them to go through. But clearly, some of the sentiments among the members of Congress have changed. They are willing to see what that looks like. Everyone calls it the blunt instrument, but they're willing to take a look and see what the blunt instrument looks like, at least here for a while. I mean, nobody thinks this is going to end today.
Eli, do you think it's going to be devastation?
Well, it won't be devastation on the scale that has been implied. Some of the hyperbole that you're hearing is positioning to win the blame game afterward. Mm-hmm. We still are not sure who is going to be blamed by the public more for this, Republicans or Democrats. And, when things are stuck, the only thing that's left for politicians to do is ratchet up the rhetoric. And unfortunately, some of it gets, beyond what the reality is. But these cuts are going to be severe. And one of the problems is, no, tomorrow or Monday at the opening of business, America is not going to collapse. But over time, these cuts will have a real and felt effect.
Our producer, Jason Bagano's typing to me frantically that those defense furloughs are going to have a real economic impact in the South Puget Sound region, a lot of the economy is dependent on JBLM.
Right. JBLM, Joint Base Lewis-McChord, also Whidbey Island Naval Air Station. So you can find people who are going to be furloughed starting Monday all around Washington State and, as the White House has been pointing out, in just about every state in the country.
And I can imagine that the calls are coming in to the members of Congress, especially in our state, because we have that military presence. And this somewhat goes to President Obama's point about the economy. I mean, it is, you do have to pause and wonder, what will this do? The economy does have that feel that it's moving
a little bit.
And so it does seem, and this is, Congress has such a low approval rating, they're paid, they're asked to go there and do a couple of things. Avoid stuff like this would be one of those. And so here, a fragile recovery, which everyone thinks it's a fragile recovery, is right up on the chopping block while everyone holds their position and says, I'm not giving. Let's see what this looks like. And so I do think that the watching public, those that are aware that this is going on, is wondering. I thought these folks understood we have a fragile economy. We need to keep it moving. And even something, it is not the, you know, the devastation exactly that was, that some of the hyperbole is implying. But it is worrisome for folks to think about how the economy could keep moving, and this, their own government, the people they send there, can't agree enough to help that.
Well, that's why I say, you know, if there should be furloughs.
That was really...
I mean, there should be. Apparently, they're exempted. They're protected somewhere. But that doesn't seem
like... It's like police
right.
and fire. They need to go to work.
But they're not working.
But again, they were all on the steps on the way to the airport, which is what I saw. So
the reality is that Congress is accustomed to a one-day-a-week furlough. They only work 4 days a week normally. And part of that is travel back to districts. But in Congress, work gets done Monday.
What's the salary?
Quite high. Uh-huh. Higher than any of the employees who are going to be furlowed at Joint Base Lewis-McChord.
Exactly.
Nobody thinks this is crazy. Well, I think it's crazy.
One thing that I think is crazy is, and then I'll let Knut come in.
Live from the parking lot.
You know, you can't drive here now, Knut, because everyone will know you're breaking the law on your cell phone in the car.
Exactly. No, we'll make you hang it up.
I was a good citizen and pulled over.
Okay.
Good job. One of the things that I find crazy is that in the last round of brinksmanship, it was Republicans arguing, and I think this was over the debt ceiling standoff, that it was creating too much uncertainty in the economy. It was going to drag down the economy by creating uncertainty about the outcome. And now Republicans have flipped around to a position where they are not worried at all about the uncertainty about what the sequester cuts will bring or what the lack of a resolution will offer.
Knut?
Well, there are a couple things. One is that I think people have to get away from the notion that it's only damaging if it's dramatic. Things can be damaging in a slow motion kind of way. And one thing I would point to as being damaging was the last the fight over the debt ceiling. The first battle over the debt ceiling damaged our country's credit rating and made the cost of borrowing money more expensive. And that's essentially like a tax on everybody because, you know, that's something that does trickle down in terms of costs, in terms of impacting the economic recovery. And so I think Joni and Eli are right on about that. But the bigger risk is the problems that you create that are sort of slow motion and chronic and ongoing. And I think that's the damage of the dysfunction. People, I think, could live with some significant budget cuts if they were done in a reasonable way and they weren't done in a way that would cause harm, even if it's slow motion harm. And then, you know, some of the problems probably won't be slow motion. And I think, I mean, the one advantage will be, you know, it'll give people a chance, I guess, to experience ways in which they're reliant on the government that is invisible to them. They just take it for granted.
We've got several listeners who've weighed in here, so I want to read their comments. We're going to open the phones, 206-543-5869. Beth, I'll end with Beth's question. Rich says, two wars later, it's the first time we've been asked to endure some pain. Ron says, Congress should be horsewhipped by seniority. I think most of us who object to that sort of thing would, in this case, look the other way.
Now, you get fewer lashings the more senior you are, or the more?
More, because you're supposed to be in charge. And Beth has a question about the sequester. I've heard that it has increments over the next 10 years. Is that true? Do any of you know how it works? Eli does, of course.
Well, I think what she's hearing is a variation on what we were all just saying, that it doesn't all take effect in full on Monday. It will be meted out over a long period of time. So it's not exactly incremental. There's a fixed amount, as I understand it, but it's not immediately all felt.
Joni Balter and Eli Sanders and Knut in the parking lot are with us talking about politics. We're going to take a short break. A whole lot more to talk about, including tax increases at the state level, Republicans signing on to protest California's Proposition 8. Lots, 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 and we want to hear from you here on 94.9 KUOW.
This is Mara Liasson from NPR News. When it comes to the news, KUOW and NPR are dedicated to bringing you the whole story, beyond the headlines and sound bites. And your support makes that possible. Mail in your gift or go online to KUOW.org and pledge your support today. Thanks.
53 degrees in Seattle. And Knut, is it raining out there?
It is not raining.
Not raining. Ray. Thank you. Live from Montlake, Knut Berger with that weather update. Thanks, Knut.
Support for KUOW comes from TherapySearch.net, a place to turn when making the important decision of choosing a counselor, providing information to help those seeking counseling make educated choices and find psychotherapists who meet their needs. On the web at TherapySearch.net.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman in for Steve Scherr, and this is weekday Friday. Our regular panel of journalists is almost all here, two-thirds here. How appropriate, as we're going to talk about the two-thirds supermajority. Joni Balter is here. Knut Berger is not here. Eli Sanders is here. And you're here at 206-543-5869. We were talking about the sequester, which goes into effect. And Pat wants to know, could all of the states that have initiative processes put one on the ballot to propose a constitutional amendment that their respective legislatures would not pay Congress people for every day in which they did not pass an appropriations bill in a timely manner and did not provide appropriations to pay the country's bills? I don't think so.
I don't think so. I don't think you can go from the states to do that on the federal level. I do think one point that we just you can't say enough is that the brinkmanship is wearying people. It's like, didn't we just do this 2 months ago, although it was a different topic? But it's this notion that the only way that Congress and the president can get anywhere is to have these forced dates of, remember, you know, the countdown clock, just these forced moments where it's the, you know, and it's the only time some people pay attention. But when they're paying attention, they cannot be impressed. It's watching something that doesn't work. And so it's very rough for Congress, which has a low approval rating anyway.
14%.
Are they up to 14% now?
14%.
Okay, because they had been down to single digits there for a minute or two. And so it really is a shame that we are governing in a way that has the brinkmanship as sort of a regular feature of it.
Forced date is a very good way of putting it. The images from the meeting this morning between John Boehner and Barack Obama afterward had both men, and especially Boehner, had the expression of someone who had been forced into a date that they didn't want to have with someone else. They both know this is not going anywhere today.
We got several more comments on this subject, and then I'm going to switch topics. Pete says, what about passing a budget? It's been 3 years since there's been one. When will the peasants get fed up and storm the castle? Send in the seafare pirates. Robert says, once the sequestration's firmly in place, let's furlough Congress. Let's not pay them for every day they fail to show up, for every day they refuse to do the job we're paying them to do, for every day they dodge the issues. I'm with you, Robert. Sign me up. And Frank says, regarding the sequester, remember Patty Murray was one of those urging to bring it on.
You know, I don't think we use the seafare
pirates
enough, and that was just such an interesting image there.
Well, it take them a long time to get there in that boat that you
see. We send them around.
I would get them some mileage points, you know.
So the state Supreme Court yesterday issued a long-awaited, for some people, a 20-year-long-awaited ruling on our law that requires any tax increase to get approval from two-thirds of the legislature. I think that Tim Iman first sponsored his initiative, or first got one passed in 1993. There have been many...
1999.
I think it was
695. 695.
I think it was 20 years ago.
20 years ago. Oh. And there have been ever so many legal challenges, but this is the first time that the state Supreme Court has actually acted on that. So Austin Jenkins, our Olympia correspondent, said that it was because it was staged to do that. But in any case, was the time ripe?
I'm not sure what he means by staged to do that.
That the lawmakers all came in and staged something that would not pass through the legislature so that they could challenge it.
Well, they tested the law. And that's a good way to find out if something is constitutional or not. And the Supreme Court said no. This was a very, very long time in coming. And if you consider what the Supreme Court said and how life could have been different in Washington State over the last 20 years, or particularly over the last 4 or 5 years in the midst of the Great Recession, had there not been a two-thirds majority requirement for raising revenue, you can see the tremendous cost in terms of wasted time and wasted opportunity of living under this unconstitutional law.
Knut, you're back, I understand, on a different line.
Yes, I am.
You sound a little bit closer. Are you still in the parking lot?
Yeah, still in the parking lot. Yeah.
Good. But this way we're not running out your cell phone, I hope, too badly. I wanted to bring you in about this because immediately within, you know, an hour, Rodney Tom, who's the head of that coalition in the state Senate, said they're going to we should respect the will of the people, and we're going to bring it up that we permanently enshrine the two-thirds rule. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because essentially, in order to enshrine that, certainly legally, you'd have to have a state constitutional amendment, which is now the legal path for getting that done. The other is the political path, which is that the two-thirds rule is popular. It's come up for a vote numerous times. It's passed. There is political, people are politically in favor of it. And that's going to create pressure on legislators to, vote for a constitutional amendment if and when that comes up. I think the ruling was correct, and it wasn't a particularly close decision, and obviously was, well considered over a long period of time. And I think it's definitely the right way to go.
One of the ironies, of course, is that it will take a two-thirds vote of both houses of the legislature to create a constitutional amendment. So that makes it very difficult if you consider the makeup of both the House and the Senate. That said, there is, as Skip said, still a popular support for the two-thirds. So lawmakers were so careful in the news accounts as to how they described what might happen next. You saw a lot of Democrats saying, well, that doesn't mean there'll be a tax increase. You saw sort of a very careful answer from the governor saying that doesn't mean there'll be an automatic tax increase. But it does change the dynamic there because they don't have that same rule.
I want to just shout out to listeners. I'm curious because everybody talks about how overwhelming the public support is for this two-thirds rule. So, listeners, do you think that it should take a two-thirds vote of the legislature to pass any kind of tax increase? 206-543-5869. Eli, what do you think about all of it?
Well, I think that it's correct that there's not going to be a tax increase immediately simply because there's a Republican majority in the state Senate that will block it, if nothing else. But I also find something a little off about the continued retreat to the idea that popular majorities approve the two-thirds majority idea. What's off about it is that popular majorities also elected every single justice on the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is a popularly elected body in this state. And so the will of the people is being exercised in two different directions here. And when people vote for something that is unconstitutional, their popularly elected justices have a duty to point that out. And it's not as if people haven't voted for unconstitutional Iman initiatives in the past. David Goldstein tallied up Iman's win and loss record over his entire career, and it's something like 6 of his initiatives, all of them passed by a popular majority, have been found unconstitutional. It's possible to put something that sounds good in front of the people, knowing that it's unconstitutional, or not knowing, but not paying enough attention to know that it's unconstitutional. In fact, only 2 of Iman's initiatives have actually withstood scrutiny by the high court.
The other thing go ahead, Skip.
Excuse me. I have a hunch that one of the more immediate effects before we get to tax increases might be that it will give the legislature more flexibility on things like closing loopholes, mm-hmm. and that you might see that some more initiative exercise there, which may not have the effect on the public of seeming I think people can distinguish between eliminating a loophole and creating a new tax.
That's an excellent point, because that may be sort of the more subtle version of what occurs, and it still generates money for the legislature. The other interesting thing that happened with this was that right after the court ruling came down, Senator Rodney Tom talked about making the two-thirds rule the rule of the Senate, but that would then defer to Brad Owen, who said, wait a minute, I mean, I don't know that I could do such a thing because we just had a ruling from the Supreme Court.
That it was
unconstitutional. So that seemed to have gone away by late in the day, that idea.
Nice picture of Pam Roach on the front page of your newspaper.
That was just, that spoke volumes. You know, she gets pretty animated about these things. She had her T-shirt that said she was really still screaming for that. And they got a committee vote for a constitutional amendment. But that's probably as far as that will go.
I've shouted out to listeners who have responded, so I'm going to bring some of them into our conversation. Hi, Kirk in Woodinville. You want to weigh in on the two-thirds rule?
Yeah, I don't think we ever need to have the two-thirds rule. We have elections every couple of years to take care of legislators who don't vote the way that the people want. And I really agree that it's perfect that Don Benton and Pam Roach were on the front of the Times. Don Benton, Mr. We Deserve a Special Cafeteria digs back in the 90s, and then Pam Roach, serial staff abuser. How do those people continue to get elected?
That's a whole other question, but thanks for joining us. We go now to Madison Park, where Michael's holding on. Hi, Michael.
Good morning.
Hi.
I am also in favor of a majority vote only for any legislation that is passed. That seems to be the way our country was founded and at least has developed into. And so I don't like the two-thirds vote majority, especially since it doesn't take two-thirds of the people to pass a two-thirds vote majority.
Oh, that's interesting. Did it just take a simple majority to win?
Yes.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, I'm just musing out loud. Thanks for calling in. It won by how much?
Well, an initiative passes with a simple majority, I think, is what she's saying.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
There's maybe a little bit of an irony there.
Some emails. Christopher says, notice most counties who had the highest votes in favor of the most recent initiative take the most from the state budget. I don't know about that for sure. John says it should not take two-thirds majority to pass a tax increase. Karen just says, I vote no. let's go to, let's see, I have got my clock over the name. Mike in Redmond, thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to go back to the comment that, you know, not only are our justices popularly elected, but our initiatives are popularly elected. And yet it's not the entire population that votes. It's not even the entire eligible voters that votes. So they're not, our population is not all represented by those initiatives. And yet our population is entirely represented by all our legislators. So if our legislators should be making this vote because they represent the entire population, not just some initiative put forth by a small fraction of the voters.
Thanks, Steve.
If you have a concern about the small fraction of voters that are actually participating in elections, the answer, though, of course, is for more people to vote. That's not a problem that can be solved by the legislature or the state Supreme Court.
Well, that's a whole other question. Why more people don't vote?
And we have fairly
decent participation in the state of Washington because of the all-male voting. We do pretty well compared to most states, but you can always do better.
What we're seeing also in this vote outcome is the result of high participation in judicial elections in King County specifically. In 2010, King County voters were responsible for kicking Justice Richard B. Sanders off the high court. In 2012, they were responsible for paying attention to the very odd race between Justice Stephen Gonzalez and Bruce Danielson, who had a chance at winning even though he had no name recognition based on latent prejudices in the voting population that caused people to pick just a name, an Anglo name like Danielson over Gonzalez, and the lack of a voter's guide, which the state couldn't afford because the state didn't have enough revenue to pay for it because of the two-thirds majority requirement. But the attention to these two races in King County among voters and the press caused Gonzalez to win, caused Justice Charlie Wiggins to win over Justice Sanders. And those two votes are the difference between the two-thirds majority requirement being upheld or struck down.
And another change, you know, this is an interesting just sort of development along the way here. We used to, for school levies, have a 60% threshold.
Right.
And the legislature, if I'm not mistaken, the legislature went after that because there was you know, a lot of operating levies that were hit coming in at about 52, 54, 56%. And so, you know, we've been talking about this what is the right threshold for some time.
I want to go now to Gary, who's holding in Seattle. Hi, Gary. Gary?
You should get a job. But aside from that, I don't see why 50.5% of the vote gets you a two-third veto. It's just a right-wing trick. It sounds kind of good, but it's just a stumbling block in the path of sane governance. And it's you know, they like it and it works, but people, if they think about it, they'd see how unfair it really is.
Thanks for calling in. I have yet to see anybody who is in favor, and is this just perpetuating the stereotype of public radio listeners that we're all a bunch of liberals?
Well, I think it's more like this. I think when the Supreme Court weighs in, there is a certain finality to that on a certain topic. It's the Supreme Court. It's not. There's nowhere else to go here on this state matter. So I think that it has that finality, and the folks who, I mean, there were some lawmakers that were saying, you know, that we should live by the will of the voters, but your callers are not exactly going that route, possibly just because of the sort of full force of the Supreme Court saying something, and they said it clearly.
There's also the potential that an idea that the Supreme Court majority alluded to has sunk in, and that is that the two-thirds majority requirement enshrined a tyranny of the minority in the state legislature, where a minority of legislators, and a relatively small one, could block any legislation, which is not what the framers of our state constitution intended, according to 6 out of 9 high court justices.
But you're a lawmaker in the state of Washington, and you know what the 5 votes on these kinds of measures are. And that is in your mind as you cast a vote for some sort of tax increase or whatever it comes before you.
I guess, Knut, I'm going to just throw it back to you for the last comment on this.
I'm not really sure what else to say on the topic. I mean, I think that Joni's right. The balance is going to be between what's constitutionally and constitutional and what's politically viable. I think people have said that they're not against. I don't think people are against tax increases. They just wanted a high bar. And if the legislature can impose upon itself a bar and make the political case that whatever tax increases or closed loopholes or whatnot are necessary, they'll have to make that case and make it politically. And I think that's exactly what should happen. I mean, I don't think that supermajority rule had any place in law. But the onus will still be on the legislature to do the right thing and then make their case.
And I'm going to end this discussion with this email from Neil. KOW's broadcast area is dominated by the 6 legislative districts that were the only ones to reject the two-thirds requirement. All counties and all other legislative districts passed it. Statewide, it got 65%, almost two-thirds. Your crowdsourcing is not representative. Maybe not. We leave that now, because with the state Supreme Court decision, that's the end of that conversation. We continue with more stories in the news with Eli Sanders of The Stranger, Joni Balter of the Seattle Times, and Knut Parking Lot Berger of Crosscut.com here on 94.9 KUOW.
-53 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. If it's not raining at the moment, there's still a chance of rain through the day. Afternoon high 59. Tonight, clouds, a low of 45. Tomorrow, Saturday, looks like clouds with rain likely in the afternoon and a high of 54.
Support for KUOW comes from AEG Live, presenting the Mary Moore Park Concert Series with Pink Martini at King County's Mary Moore Park on August 4th. Tickets on sale now at AXS.com. More information at MaryMooreConcerts.com.
An Egyptian-American has run marathons in all 50 states. Now he's running one in Israel, and he's even considered running the Jerusalem Marathon without shoes.
Barefooted.
Barefoot?
Absolutely. It's a holy place. I could not believe that I'm walking in Jerusalem wearing my shoes.
Racing 26.2 miles on holy ground, the Jerusalem Marathon next time on The World.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 7 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from the Cornell Queens Executive MBA program, designed for mid-career managers and professionals, offering weekend classes in Seattle. Local admissions events March 5th and 7th. Information and event registration at cornellseattle.com.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:39.
This is 94.9 KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman in this week and next for Steve Scher, who I hope is resting his brain. And it is Friday. We talk over the week's news with our regular panel of journalists who are almost all here. Eli Sanders is associate editor of The Stranger. Joni Balter is assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. They're in the studio, and waylaid by unfortunate traffic accidents on the Montlake Bridge is Knute Berger, editor-at-large of Seattle Magazine and the Mossback at crosscut.com, and joins us from the old Museum of History and Industry parking lot, which should be nice and empty.
You got a space,
empty,
right?
Yeah.
Got a space.
Right.
Yeah, well,
I'm right here. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'm right here at ground zero for the new 520.
Well, and there you go, because I was just going to say that one thing that I thought was so interesting this week was outgoing State Transportation Secretary Paula Hammond admitting that, in fact, the reason that those pontoons are leaking that and why there's like a zillion construction barges parked outside there is the DOT didn't really do their engineering due diligence. I was actually surprised to hear that. Shocked might not be too strong. And so, Knute, what do you think?
Well, it's a huge mistake, a huge blunder. And they did extensive internal investigation and released those reports. And I think the sobering thing was that the Department of Transportation, this wasn't a thing where they can foist the blame onto the contractor. The problem and the liability for these things is with the Department of Transportation, and they were very critical of their own staff for how it was handled. The overview process, what's happened is they found that in addition to the contractor pouring concrete pontoons and in such a way that some cracks formed, that the actual design of the pontoons was flawed, and that the testing and computer models had not been run. The design was signed off when it shouldn't have been. They talked about internal communication problems. They said that they were going to have to look at how they were managing their other mega projects, because some of these problems were had to do with WashDOT culture, and they were concerned about that. And when you look at the reports, it's they have a plan to fix it. It's going to be expensive, and they've already said it's going to delay the opening of the new bridge, pushing it from 2014 into 2015. So it's significant.
And what about that big hole they're about to dig down on the waterfront? I mean, this big tunnel, this does not make me feel confident.
Well, this is why I kept noticing that this story was the number one story in the Seattle Times for a couple of days, more than, the normal gestation period, perhaps. And I was wondering about it, myself, why is that such a big story? Because we have so many construction projects, and people are looking warily now at all of them, of course. And this one in particular, this one's underfunded. And at the same time, we're having a debate about where tolling should be. In other words, asking more people to pay more, where tolling should be or not be to pay for that shortfall that I just referenced. And so I can see why people want to read. They want to know who did what. How did this happen? Why are there these cracks? And many people see the pontoons out there and they wonder, are they okay? Are they, what's going on?
Yeah, should I be driving
should
on
I
this
be
bridge?
Driving?
I mean, I was already nervous about driving on the viaduct when they told me it was cracked and sinking. So essentially, or is this a grand ploy? The conspiracy theorist in me wonders to just all get out of our cars and ride around on bicycles.
Well, I think one of the issues here that comes through, my second grade teacher at John Muir Elementary, Mrs. Miettinen was her name, and she was one of those teachers that was always saying, haste makes waste, we'd run across the classroom with the scissors, haste makes waste. Paula Hammond said that one of the reasons that they had problems with the pontoons is they were in a hurry. The governor had set a very definitive schedule as to when she wanted 520 opened, the new 520 bridge opened. And she said that's not an excuse. Well, we're finding that is also true in the case with the Chetsamoka ferry, which is that the new ferry that the state built, and it looked like we paid about $50 million more for that ferry than the original design would have warranted because of cost overruns and customization. But that was also a project that was done in a hurry.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, one of the things you talk about the waterfront project and the tunnel. I mean, we complain about gridlock in Seattle, but the fact is there's been a lot of pressure because of jobs, because of budgets and other things to get projects underway. And, the viaduct replacement project began before we'd even decided what we were doing on the central waterfront. So time pressures, I think, mega projects always have something go wrong, which is why they have contingency funds and they kind of offload risk and design build contracts and whatnot. But I think there have been a lot of time pressures here to build these projects fast in order to create a kind of unstoppable momentum for them.
And the problem with the 520 project, as I think Joni alluded to, is there is not even a fund for paying for the original project, much less now the fixing of it. There's not enough money.
There is a contingency fund. The story's addressed that. There is a contingency fund that pretty much addresses the cracking problem, but it doesn't. It would zap it. It would zap it. So as I understand it, there might not be anything left for the next problem.
And in any case, they can't pay for the entire project as it stands.
Correct. It was hard not to wonder about Paula Hammond in the last few weeks because she wanted to stay on as transportation secretary. The new governor, Jay Inslee, picked someone from Oregon and not her for that. And I'm wondering, I don't know this, I'm just wondering if the governor knew that this was going to come to the surface about how much the cracks were going to cost.
Well, our listener, Paul, points out, does no one remember that when the cracks were first found, the spokesman from the DOT said they were normal and not to be feared? I remember that. So
I don't remember that, but that alone is probably a reason for Paula Hammond to find other work.
Yeah.
Knut?
Well, I think what they found was that they're cracks and then they're cracks. The initial cracks that showed up were not They shouldn't have happened, but they were not untypical of things that have shown up in other concrete pontoons, and they were easily fixable with epoxies and that kind of thing. So there was that was something that they could kind of handle, and they could kind of blame on the contractor. But this revealed that there were much more severe cracks that were the result of actual designs that were not appropriate, and the cost of fixing is going to be very expensive. My understanding is they had a $250 million contingency fund for the project. They're down to $200 million. The fixes for these pontoons will come out of that. Nobody's willing to say yet how much that fix is going to be, but it's going to take a substantial bite out of that. There's still $1.4 billion of the project, which essentially takes it from where the new bridge stops to I-5 has not even been funded yet fully.
Robert emails us from Bainbridge Island. Dear friends, given that Hanford and the project to clean it up appears to have gone off the rails, that close to 1 million people live downriver from Hanford and depend one way or another on that, wouldn't it merit our attention? And I think he's referring obliquely to the fact that we've got a large amount of leaking radioactive waste, and with a government sequester, everything stops in terms of the cleanup. But the project to move the waste from those leaky tanks off the rails might be one way to describe it.
It's a rough week for our projects. These cracks, I don't know, the cracks in concrete pontoons doesn't sound good, even if they're this reference to they were normal cracks or they were predictable cracks was concerning anyway, right?
Because you just don't want to be driving on things that are cracked over deep water in a car that you're shut in.
That's a reasonable expectation.
That's my thought. All right, so let's jump subjects because we have just about 10 minutes left. And I was interested to see on the front page of the New York Times a few days ago that a number of prominent Republicans had signed on to a friend of the court brief that seeks to overturn California's Proposition 8. This is the anti-gay marriage proposition that came into play after gay marriage was legalized for a brief period of time in that state. And I want to start with you, Eli, because you followed this. And were you surprised?
I was not shocked. It was a little surprising, but not shocked in the sense that the culture is shifting on this. And the Republican Party has had a split. I don't know if it's, you know, an even split, but it is a split on this issue that they've had for a long time. And the more, socially evolved people in the party for quite a long time have been saying, we need to get further along on this issue. We need to get the party in sync with a majority of Americans on this issue. And so it was good to see Republicans stepping forward and saying that in the form of an amicus brief that could have some sway as the court is deciding this. This is going to be a huge, huge case and very, very interesting to watch when it comes before the court.
Well, this case is happening at a time of a huge shift in public opinion. I mean, it's one of those issues that has changed so much even in the last year or two. And so you watch the people who are coming forward to say that they've been on a journey, they've had a new thought about it, that things are changing the way they see it. And in this case, you have some people who worked for George W. Bush who, you know, have a different thought about it. Dick Cheney came out a while back. Everyone knows he has a daughter who's a lesbian. And even he said that. Meg Whitman, from California. So a lot of people have been rethinking this. And clearly, and this has been said a number of times, but clearly that one thing that you know, any Republican Party or any Republican official sort of saying, what are we going to do next as a party, any of this soul searching, check in with the younger voters. And their opinions are not subtle on this. They're driving the big change. And so anyone who's trying to appeal to the new group of voters, the up-and-coming voters, has to recognize the polling.
Knut, I don't know if you had something else to say, but my question to you has to do with whether it's a change in attitude or whether people finally feel like, well, there's enough societal shift that they can actually say what they think.
I think it's both. I think it's both. I mean, I think part of it is political. Part of it is people thinking deeply about the issue in ways they haven't before. You're finding a kind of ideological justification for it. Now, whether it's going to affect the Supreme Court in any way and how they decide, I can't imagine public opinion really mattering much to Scalia, or some of the other justices. But I think it's certainly important too, from the standpoint of where some people in the Republican Party want to reposition the party, which is a party that's more in tune, as Joni was suggesting, with young people, and a party that's, you know, more in the mainstream of culture. But it, you know, they're fighting some significant cross tensions,
right,
in the party.
And I was just going to bring that up, Joni and Eli, who are sitting here. This is a party that is not a singular entity by any means. I mean, it's
right. If you think of the fact that the Tea Party gave a response to the State of the Union, that tells you right there. That's pretty unusual to have two responses from the party that's not in the presidency. That shows you another version of the rift.
So are we at some point working our way to a multi-party nation as opposed to this two-party system we've had for so long?
A lot of people think that's inevitable if the Republican Party continues on the path that it's on, and that would be quite interesting, actually. I mean,
Well, it'd be more like other nations in the world that don't just have two. Some have none. But
check out Italy this week, you know.
Oh, well, you know, what you mentioned Italy. I just have to say we now have a Pope Emeritus.
Pope Emeritus. What are you going to do?
I know. I don't know if any of you follow papal news, but I've found it when I stop to think about it, because I don't think about it all that often, but the fact that this is the first time in 600 years that somebody has stepped away from a job of significant power is kind of fascinating to me.
Yes, and it's so interesting to watch how they're going to cover up any issues that they have that have the word scandal with it, and then also proceed with what's supposed to be a very orderly process, ending with the smoke where they name
the white smoke. There's
white smoke.
Black,
yeah, you got to have the right, yeah,
right color.
Thanks,
smoke.
Thanks for that. And ending with some orderly announcement of a new pope. And lots of talk about who that new pope might be. Might it be somebody from
Canada,
from Africa or South America? Which is, there's a lot of talk about that.
Well, you can't help think about the Republican Party when you think about the Catholic Church, which is also an entity that is certainly got its factionalism in a big way. I don't know about popedom. We've got some listeners going back to the 520 Bridge, you know, news.
Pope, 520 Bridge.
Same thing.
Same thing.
Nick emails, as an engineer, I always tell my clients there are three things they need to know about concrete. It's gray, number one. Number two, it's heavy. Number three, it cracks.
Oh, boy.
There are normal cracks in all concrete, but the pontoon cracks are not normal. So that's an engineering issue. And let's see, William takes you, Joni, to task just to say that you need to give credit to Como and Tracy Vetter for exposing the problems in the first place. And R.E. Tolls, an important correction. The debate isn't about where tolling will take place, but if tolling will take place. Your group may not be aware of the depth of feeling people have about these draconian prospects that the state will try to force down our throat. Various anti-tolling groups, I think, I'm adding anti-tolling, are forming as we speak, and we're all fired up.
Can I address that?
Yes, you may.
The tolling. Yeah. I'm just going to say that I did a story earlier this week about the state's hiring a new tolling auditor, and the ad, the want ad, was very interesting because it acknowledged in the ad the person who takes this position within WSDOT will be overseeing tolling, and we don't really know how to do tolling here in the West, so we need somebody with some experience. And by the way, you're going to have to be really good at communication because the public is very skeptical about tolling.
That sounds like a great job.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it was at least kind of truth in advertising. They're saying it's going to be pretty unappealing.
So if they second only to the pot expert that the state is looking for right now, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But maybe we'll end up
no
with
question.
Maybe we'll end up. Sorry, Knut, go ahead.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say, from the standpoint of policy, official policy, tolling, they intend to toll, and they intend to toll in a lot of different places over time. So, people who are against tolling, it's going to require a lot of activism to shift the policy thing. And one would think that if you eliminate the two-thirds rule, you might get tax increases that would perhaps replace tolling or make tolling less onerous.
That's so. Such a Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm attitude about taxes. Eli?
That one, it just seemed tailor-made for one of those Northeast Corridor characters who can talk about tolling from personal experience and would love to get into it with the people who want to argue about tolling. So maybe
you're going to bring somebody from the Massachusetts area to talk about the Mass
like
Pike?
New Jersey, like New York. Christie character. That would be, that's kind of what the state needs.
Right, by somebody who was mentored by Robert Moses.
Right. Well, maybe not that. But someone who mixes it up like Christie does would be very interesting to have in the tolling debate.
Well, you mentioned Christie. I just flashed on him determining that he was going to go with, accept the money with the Medicaid and the changes with the health care reform.
When the Republican Party folks gather, they must have like at least a moment every time when they're figuring out what they're going to do next. There must be an agenda item called What to Do About Chris Christie.
Well, I find him a fascinating character and certainly always great journalism. And with that, we can, I guess, hope for as much news next week because it certainly makes for lively conversation, but maybe a little calmer. Alphabetically, Joni Balter is assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Knut Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut.com, who's written a book called Space Needle, The Spirit of Seattle. And perhaps in that parking lot at Mohai, Knut, you can contemplate a new book about traffic patterns and bridges.
I will do.
How we get along. And certainly not least, but last in this list is Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Thanks for coming in today. Bernard Ouellette is the man at the helm. Weekday produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Al-Sadi, and Andy Hurst. Danielle Anthony Goodwin is our intern. I'm Marcy Silman, in for Steve Scherer this week and next. Hope you all have a great weekend.
Now let's set aside the news for a moment, just a moment, and think back to when you were a little kid, 6 years old. What do you think the six-year-old you would think about who you are today? Would that sweet, innocent little kid like who you turned out to be? Would he or she be proud of the grown-up you? Let us know your thoughts. 206-221-3663. 206-221-3663. What did you think you would be like as an adult? And then, who did you actually become? 206-221-3663. We're sharing those stories this afternoon at 1240. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Kirkland Performance Center, presenting Kevin Eubanks and Stanley Jordan, Just the Two of Us. Leader of Jay Leno's Tonight Show Orchestra, Kevin Eubanks, performs a double bill concert with jazz guitarist Stanley Jordan. Tuesday, March 5th at 7:30 p.m. at Kirkland Performance Center. Tickets at kpcenter.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.